She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thank you so much for joining us today. This show is sponsored by Chapman Tucson. I always like to thank them for their support and for doing what they are doing to make a difference for the planet, because Lord knows we need them. I am very excited to welcome our guest today. His name is Dr. David Orr. He is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics and Special Assistant to the President at Oberlin College. And in his spare time, and I'm saying this so tongue-in-cheek, he is Executive Director of the Oberlin Project. He's the recipient of 7 honorary degrees and numerous other awards, which might just take half the show to list. So just know that you're going to be blessed by having one very brilliant man share his views with us today about the critical imperative for ecological literacy. So please get ready for a great show. Thanks for joining me. And David, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, Gina, thanks for having me.
I know you're flying one place and then the other and then the next, and you are a sought-after man, and don't be humble about it.
Well, there's a lot of stuff to do.
There's a lot of stuff to do.
As well as anybody, and the time is short, and we've got a long way to go.
And I do say sometimes sleep is for sissies. So let me just do one brief announcement about a national sponsor, Ecobella. The work they're doing is important, and it is all part of the ecological literacy that we need to be aware of. It is June. It's people go outside, they hike, they camp, it's beach time. And I've said this each week in June, my caution to all of you, please make sure that you protect your skin and your family's skin from the sun when you're spending lots of time outside. And maybe even more importantly, read the ingredients of what's in your products to make sure that you're not doing more harm than good because of the harsh chemicals, because of fair trade. Where are they sourcing their products? Take a look, because every bit of it matters. Again, it's Ecobella with 2 C's. Look them up online, and I am sure you'll be happy what you find. Once you vet them, you don't have to worry about their products. Cruelty-free, the list goes on. So let's get on with the star of our show. David, I love saying that. I was so happy to spend time with you and your wife in Monterey, which seems like months ago, especially because it's 112 in Tucson today. I'd like to be taking a little walk with you along the ocean.
You bet.
It's really hard. So let's start off with, I don't want to chit-chat. I really want you to share with our audience so much of what you have to help us with tools and the overall message that you want to give to thousands. And I know this will be one of the ways that you can get it out. So if we could, let's start with the overall message of your book. You wrote a book called Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. And my first question is maybe a zinger, but are we down to the wire?
Well, I think we are.
I think we are.
In some ways, we're beyond the wire. And this is the hardest thing to message we've ever had as a species, because it's global. It isn't just a U.S. issue or a Chinese issue. This is all people on the planet and for a long time to come. And the first warning that was given to a U.S. president about climate change was in 1965. And President Obama's speech last week was great, but we still do not have a national climate policy. That would require Congress to act, and they are not so inclined. But time is short, and the problem that is the most difficult thing to message, I believe, is the fact that once you've changed atmospheric chemistry, which we're doing very rapidly, it stays changed for a long time. We're talking about thousands of years to recover the kind of atmosphere we had even 100 years ago. So time is short to head off the worst that could be ahead.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. We're way past the wire. Do things like President Obama's speech help move us more towards some meaningful progress in terms of federal climate legislation? It doesn't seem to me like it's going to.
Well, the issue has divided our movement a bit, hasn't it? Because people on one side say we can't, you got to be positive, you got to be upbeat, you got to be bipartisan. But when the other side doesn't come to the table, then there is a huge problem. Because democracy, there are a lot of ways to destroy a democratic process. And one of the ways is somebody just will not play by the rules or will not come to the table. And the fact is that climate change is the largest threat this country, and I think, frankly, humans have ever faced. But certainly it's more than just an environmental issue, which is where it tends to get pigeonholed. It is a national security issue par excellence. It dwarfs almost any other, well, I think it dwarfs every other security issue you could name. It's an issue that is economic. It concerns virtually everything that humans do. And so it cannot be made simply a partisan or democratic or liberal issue. It is bigger than all of those. This is a national issue. It's a global issue.
And from where you sit, do we need to keep pushing on many other levels, not just at the federal level? What can we do in the local level, bring it down to the micro level of our own actions? So you, I know that part of what I've read and I heard you speak is it's not just about let's leave it to the feds. Let's start with me.
I think that's right. And eventually the change has to be at the personal, local, regional level anyway. And so the faster we get to moving on that level, the easier I think it'll be. But we need at the federal level, we need to be able to price carbon and carbon-based fuels, and that's oil and natural gas and coal, at their true cost. And right now, they're nowhere near their true cost. So, in effect, we're living well by pushing a pile of debt off on our kids and their kids and their kids as far out as you can imagine. And the irony in all of this is it's almost entirely unnecessary. Most all of this is waste. I had a conversation with a professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh about a month ago, and I asked him, how much energy is in fact wasted in the U.S. energy budget? And without missing a beat, he said 80%.
Oh,
in other words, we could run the economy, given existing technology, with better design, better technology, on about a fifth of the amount of energy we currently use. Now, let's assume that's way too optimistic. Maybe it's 40%, but that still means we're wasting 60% of the energy we consume. And this is entirely gratuitous because the burden then falls on our children and their children and off into the future. And it is entirely unnecessary. If you ask, can you build buildings powered by sunshine, the answer is sure, absolutely. We know how to do that. We've done that in cloudy Ohio, and how much easier would it be in Phoenix, Arizona, or California? It isn't a matter of technology. It really is not a matter of economics. It's a matter of leadership.
When you talk about, just go back for a minute, when you talk about 80% is wasted, so give an example, because I think I know the answer, but coal, we extract it, then we transport it to get the energy to our, wherever we're going to take the energy to. I mean, is that part of the 80% of it's wasted before it's actually used as energy to heat or cool someone's home or building?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about the energy chain, that begins with mines and wells. And any good business person knows that the bottom line is how much money, or in this case, energy, it takes to make money or to make energy or to produce energy. And so the energy, what's called the energy return on investment, it's kind of a wonky sounding phrase, but in fact, it's critically important that we understand that energy doesn't come free. Spindletop in Texas, back at the turn of the 20th century, you could put in a unit of energy and take out 100 units of energy. That's a pretty good deal. The return on investment for offshore wells, where you have to go further out and deeper down and run all kinds of hazards, as we saw with the BP spill a couple of summers ago, very destructive, very expensive, and all that means lots of energy expended to take out a barrel of oil. At the point where it takes a barrel of oil to get a barrel of oil, there's no point in doing it.
And so, why don't people, David, why you go all over the world speaking, why don't people get upset about subsidies, about us supporting companies to produce energy for us. And then all of, like, in Arizona, in Tucson and Phoenix, we've had any support for solar, like solar, locally owned solar companies are going out of business about weekly. And to me, it's like I get enraged when I hear what you say, because where are people in their outrage of we're spending our taxpayers' money to subsidize the big companies?
Well, Gina, if we were lawyers, the answer would be pretty brief. This is a $3 or $4 trillion a year business, and the old adage of just follow the money.
Right.
There are a lot of legislators at the state level and the federal level who, frankly, without glossing a bit, have been just simply bought out.
And
so
they rule.
It's hard. Somebody once said a long time ago, Lewis Carroll, actually, that wrote Alice in Wonderland, said that it's hard to reason a person out of a position that they didn't reason themselves into. And the problem with a lot of people who represent or are supposed to represent the public interest is they have no reasoned position on these things. And in the meantime, they're paid a very good salaries and so forth, and the oil companies and the coal companies keep them in office, and so it's a very cozy relationship. But if I don't think it's hard to explain. I think the system is virtually entirely corrupted with way too much money. And that's no revelation to you or any of the listeners on the line. There's just way too much money in the system. And it means that what is a diffuse public interest, where nobody is all that passionate about it, but the polls show people support solar, runs up against a very concentrated, well-funded, fanatical interest by a small number of people. And a small number of well-funded fanatics can be a cork in a bottle, so to speak, and stop change. And that's exactly what's happened for the better part of a century in the United States.
And I don't know, we just hope people wake up. But anyway, I called your show Designing Resilience in a Black Swan World. So one of the terms that I was so excited by when I heard you speak in Monterey and then read more about it, I was calling it integrated thought, and you're calling it full spectrum sustainability versus one-off isolated projects. Can you just expand on that concept and why it's so critical that there is full spectrum sustainability?
Yeah, and let's build on, I'd like to start with where we were about the price of energy. I go to a gas pump, and I can buy gasoline at current prices around, $3.50
right.
a gallon. That doesn't include any of the subsidies that go to oil companies, which are huge, billions of dollars per year. It doesn't include the carbon effects that come out of my tailpipe, go up into the atmosphere,
right.
and then helps to change climate. And it doesn't include oil spills. It doesn't include all the what economists call externalities. And so I'm not paying the full cost of gasoline I use. And so a full spectrum approach to that particular issue means if I understand that issue, I've got to know something about ecology. I've got to know something about economics. I've got to know something about the results or the effects of what I do in the world. And we live in such a siloed world where issues are isolated from other issues. And so by any phrase, you can call it integrated thought, you can call it systems thinking, you can call it full spectrum sustainability, but what it simply means is we have to learn to connect the dots. We have to see things in relationship to other things. And this is, I make my living as an educator, and this is, for me, one of the major tasks of education, to equip people to understand the ecological and social and ethical implications of everything that they do. You burn coal to get electricity, and here on the East Coast, we take a lot of coal out of West Virginia by whacking off the tops of mountains, dumping the what's called overburden, a kind of an interesting word, down into valleys, so you wreck whole areas. And right now, the total is about 1.2 or 3 million acres have been turned into moonscape, ostensibly for cheap electricity. Well, there's nothing at all cheap about that electricity. It's a scam. And what it means is we're pushing this bow wave of debt and obligation and degraded landscapes off on our kids and their kids as far out as you care to imagine. And so by any description, seeing things in patterns and connecting dots simply means understanding the terms by which we live. And then having, hopefully, the moral and ethical and political wherewithal to begin to recalibrate those, to get them into relationship with each other. And so if I buy a car, the first idea of full spectrum or systems thinking means I buy a car only after I've eliminated all the other options. Do I need a car? How big a vehicle do I need? Are there other options? Can I use a bicycle? Can I walk? Can I use public transportation? And so all these things need to be seen as part of a larger system and pattern.
And
it seems for us that's the hardest thing in the world to do. Americans tend to do these things in isolation.
I just could not agree with you more. And as I became so aware of every single action that I take, it's like people, we're all part of one planet, and everything you do either contributes or takes away from the sustainability of that planet. But anyway, so examples of synergies that exist between these parts is how you designed the Oberlin Project. You looked at it, you used the conscious term, full spectrum sustainability, to design it. Let's talk a little bit about how this segued and how did the Oberlin Project come about. And of course, we cannot finish the show without me asking why the metaphor of the black swan. But let's start out with how you designed it. And I know it wasn't just you, but all of the full spectrum concept and what went into the design of the Oberlin Project.
Well, let me back up a little bit and say Oberlin, for your listeners, is a small town 14 miles south of the south shore of Lake Erie, about 35 miles southwest of Cleveland, on a straight line. Detroit's about 84 miles across Lake Erie. Toledo's over to our west. Youngstown's over to our east. So we're right smack in the old industrial heart of the United States. This
right.
was
the whole corridor.
Engine, yeah, that drove the American economy. And now it's struggling, as everybody knows. People have moved to Phoenix and Tucson and California and so forth and left this area kind of high and dry. So that's where we are. It's an area with a lot of water. It was an agricultural area. And then the town of Oberlin was founded in 1832, and it became one of the sites on the Underground Railroad where slaves escaped. Slaves from the South came through Oberlin, stayed here, and then were given safe passage to Canada. The college where I teach was founded in 1833, and it was the first college to accept African Americans and women and graduate both of them. It was said to be the town that started the Civil War because of a historical incident called the Wellington Rescue that involved an escaped Kentucky slave by the name of John Price. So that's where we are. The college has had a long-term commitment to justice and fairness and decency, and it's very famous for one of the great conservatories in music in the world, the Oberlin Conservatory. The science program here turns out more young kids that go on for PhDs in the sciences than any other comparable liberal arts college in the country, and that's year after year. So it's one of the very distinguished colleges in American higher education. The origin of the Oberlin Project, it goes back to about the year 2008, 2009, and began to look at a number of things that were going on here that involve agriculture and energy and so forth. And there was so much interest in developing a sustainable town that we began to put these things together under this umbrella phrase. So we said, let's do five things. Let's first of all rebuild the downtown economy. We live in the Rust Belt. Our poverty level is right around 20 to 25%. That's a lot higher than it should be. So the first goal was to do economic development, but do it in a way that was sustainable. And the second goal was to get to carbon neutrality. These are, of course, related kinds of things, but we were selected as one of three cities in the United States and one of 18 worldwide that are part of the Clinton Climate Initiative. And the goal is to get to carbon neutrality. In other words, at the end of the year, we've made no net contribution of carbon to the atmosphere. The third goal involves food systems and restoring a robust local agricultural system here. Right now, the average food molecule is said to move about 1,500 miles where it's grown or produced to where it's eaten.
Right.
And whatever the number, we're not going to import our food from California much longer at a price we could afford, at a volume we need. And so food self-sufficiency is one of the major goals for us and then throughout the whole region. And then the fourth goal was to do all of this in a way that contributed to the education, not just of students K through PhD, but also within the larger community. So one of the major goals here was educational, how to begin to use the redevelopment of the city and the surrounding region as something that was really instructive to people here. And then the fifth goal was to understand how we take this little model, this tiny little model in a city of 10,000, and stretch it around the world. How do we make it go viral? So we're working with other projects and other regional clusters to take this idea of full-spectrum sustainability, whatever that means in different circumstances, up to a national movement. I mean, it's our version of a Tea Party movement, but in this case, one powered by science and sunshine. So those are the five goals. We've organized a community around seven teams.
Okay, David, we're gonna have to take a quick break, which I warned you about. But when we come back, let's pick up there. And another thing I would like you to just go to a little bit is when you said, you know, create jobs that are truly sustainable. I'd love to have an example of that, because people who are in favor of fracking say things like, yeah, well, create sustainable jobs, which, of course, chokes Mrs. Green. So
sure.
We will be back in a minute. We are. I have the pleasure of interviewing Dr. David Orr. He's the Paul Scars Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Public, let's just say, Executive Director of the Oberlin Project. We're going to go aloud to music, David. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back.
All right.
University of Arizona professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at ChapmanTucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives?
Well, it's true.
It's true.
Well, it's true.
Goodwill.
Goodwill gave my son a chance.
My mom, hope.
My brother, a sense of purpose.
And help my dad find a job.
Goodwill helps thousands of people.
People like us every year.
People like us.
Every year. Your donations to Goodwill do change lives. Please donate today.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I think I want to add another line to that. We really hope you will, when you hear shows like this, that you will start thinking about the impact, about full spectrum sustainability, and try to figure out what part you can be to be the change in the world. I'm so pleased to be joined by Dr. David Orr. He is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics and Special Assistant to the President of Oberlin College and the Executive Director of the Oberlin Project. Before break, David was talking about the goals of the project, the five goals of the project. And David, in the first goal, you said rebuild a 13-acre block for economic revitalization with sustainable jobs. Can you give a couple of examples and what that definition means to you and meant to the Oberlin project?
Virginia, I think we're trying to discover what a sustainable economy is. Those are words I don't think they're fully understood. But in this particular case, I think the sustainable economy is one reoriented to fundamentals more than ephemeralities. And so it deals with things that humans really do need. And let's start with food. In this case, we import something like $7 or $8 billion worth of food in Northeast Ohio per year. We grow $200 million of that ourselves. So there's this discrepancy of $7 to $8 billion and then $200 million. Energy is the second. We're right now in the middle of a massive transition to solar power worldwide. And so a sustainable economy is one not only powered by solar energy, but one that manufactures solar equipment, installs it, maintains it, and so forth. And there are literally millions of jobs at stake here. And you can't outsource the solar installation business to China or Europe or anyplace else. You have to do it yourself. So our goal is to create a model, a working model of a sustainable economy based on ephemeralities and true cost pricing, and one that meets a fair portion of needs locally. So in the food system, our goal is to grow perhaps as much as 70% of the food consumed in the local community here, which is about an $18 million market, within a local region, maybe 10 or 20 miles around. But I think a sustainable economy is one that deals with things humans really do need. It'll be local, much more locally based, closer to home. It'll be an economy where you walk down the street and you deal with local merchants and so forth, and you buy food from local farmers, and the locavore movement and the local foods movement and so forth are taking off here and in Europe and elsewhere. And so that's how the economy, I think, has to go. It's an economy not built on global debt and huge banks and always at the point of collapse or whatever. It's not an economy that exploits people someplace else. It's an economy that employs people here locally. It's a labor-intensive economy more so than it is capital-intensive.
And part of that is, in my actions, it's so easy to go to a locally owned restaurant. It's so easy to go to a locally owned, even if it's to get your hair done instead of big chains. I mean, there's so many decisions we make, the locally owned camera shop and why that's important. And I have seen the proliferation of farmers markets like you wouldn't believe. 3 years ago, we may have had three in Tucson, and now I think there are 15 a week, all with seasonal vegetables. What I want to ask you is kind of funny and off the subject a little bit, but given your climate, what do you grow that can feed the city, the town, all year? And I'm sure some things have to be brought in, but what are some of your star crops that you can eat of all year?
Well, you know, you can grow mostly, this is a temperate part of the world, abundant water, pretty good soils. And there was a time when Ohio had 260 or 70,000 farms, mostly food self-sufficient. People didn't import food from long distances. That's a modern post-World War II phenomenon. It was told by a Montanan not long ago that around the time of World War II, Montana was basically self-sufficient in most all of its needs. But from local free-range chickens and organically raised beef all the way over to fruits and blueberries and nuts and so forth, we can grow a whole range of things here. So we're not deprived. What happened to the food economy was a lot of money came in, and you began to have large specialty operations and confinement feeding, what I call CAFOs, but confinement feeding and systems for cows and chickens and hogs and so forth. And so it became highly concentrated with a lot of money and a lot of capital investment. And so the old idea of a diversified farm supplying local food needs went out, not because it was inefficient. To the contrary, it was simply went out of business because it was the other farming was subsidized, and tax systems and public policy codes and so forth went the other way. But we'd have to reinvent agriculture at the local scale. And the good news is that that's a market that's virtually everywhere now, booming.
Right, it is. That gives me hope for the full spectrum sustainability. I see a lot of hope in that one. Okay, so you had the five goals of the project. And then one of the things I came away with from the Monterey Bay Aquarium is a lot of the speakers, starting with you as the keynote, gave me a very clear example of why should I care? I'd love that to be the name of my next radio show, Why Should I Care? You had to have a lot of people really invested in moving this project forward and what it meant to them, how it was going to impact their life. So why did some of the, you know, like the students care and the faculty and the public officials and the people? Can you give us some examples of why they got engaged in the process and why it's still alive and well and moving forward?
Oh, Gina, I think there's any number of motivations, but at one end of the spectrum is the fear that the world we're creating is not going to survive. And so there's the fear-driven motive. At the other end of the spectrum is the sheer joy of engaging in activities with your neighbors and friends and the craft work and so forth, and, you know, building great houses and that don't require fossil fuels. And we're getting ready to break ground this year on what will be a solar-powered hotel and conference center, and the Oberlin College Board of Trustees got very excited about it. It took 2 years of reasoning through and a lot of hard work and so forth, but in that case, there's a lot of excitement about doing something that hasn't been done very often or maybe never before.
That's so amazing. I mean, we just have to kind of press pause here, and I want to, like, ring the bell and say that is absolutely amazing. Was that in the plans, or that came about as a result of this, you know, the Oberlin project?
Well, the 13-acre block you referred to, in the, right in the heart of the downtown, is owned by the college. So the plans to do something in that block go back a long ways. The idea of replacing the existing hotel with a solar-powered, very advanced designed hotel, and one that meets U.S. Green Building Council Platinum standards, that's an add-on of the past 2 years. It was a process of reasoning through. So why do people move on these things? Well, you know, it's a range of motivations, and there is fear at one end, there's excitement at the other end, but for people who eat in local restaurants, it's just, hey, the food's better.
Right.
It's grown locally,
it tastes
better. I happen to know farmer so-and-so.
Right.
It happens to be better for you. And for kids who get involved in activities in the schools, it's a lot of fun. It's a way to learn things. And so I don't think there's much resistance to sustainability. And I think the better way to motivate people need to know that, yeah, that this is a dangerous time in human history, but on the other side, what else do you want to do? Do you want to build the same old kind of buildings and houses and so forth we did back in the 1950s, or do you want to begin to upgrade the housing stock and do something that's really exciting and celebration? So for me, the Oberlin Project, for all the seriousness of it, needs to be something like a party and a celebration.
Something fun. That's great.
Something a lot of fun. There needs to be there needs to be some real excitement and the creativity that goes into rediscovering or discovering how we begin to put the pieces together again at the local level to build a world that is sustainable, and then take that out to the wider world.
So the students got excited, the faculty, I'm sure, got excited, and then it involves, like, did it just inherently involve more jobs, architects and urban planners, and how big a role and how supportive were the public officials? Was it really an aligned intention and let's make this happen because everybody can benefit?
Well, the Oberlin Project is a joint effort of the city and the college. The college has been the driver in this, but the city has been a very strong partner. City Council has been very helpful, and city agencies and so forth. So this is a public-private partnership between a college and a city around those five goals that I mentioned. So we've organized the community around seven teams. There is a team that works on food and agricultural issues, and one that works on redevelopment issues or economic development issues and so forth. So there's a lot of civic engagement in this. The college faculty have been engaged to some degree, and people's involvement tends to depend on a particular issue and the timing and so forth. But it's a community-wide effort, and I've got to say that there hasn't been any opposition. I don't think we try to be as non-political as we possibly can be. It just aims to solve particular problems. But it's been an exciting effort. There's been a lot of public buy-in. There's a lot of national attention now. But what we're doing is simply the grassroots version of what the Tea Party movement did politically. I have a different view of politics than most Tea Party members have, but this is the idea of civic engagement. Let's remake the world. But instead of fighting about taxes in Washington, D.C., I want to know how we put a solar-powered school here in the city. I want to know how we begin to shift our food system so that we're supporting local farms and rebuilding a robust local foods economy and becoming healthier in the process and creating a prosperity that can be sustained. I want to know how we get from fossil fuels to a solar-powered and hyper-efficient economy here. And on that note, the electric system here in the city of Oberlin will be 90% or better carbon-free this year.
That's unreal. I mean, it really is. It's like I have to just press pause because that's making me have some fun. It's really an accomplishment.
We have a great group of citizens that have worked on the Public Utility Commission and have worked on energy issues collectively through the City Council and through the Oberlin Project and so forth. So there's a network of citizen groups and public agencies and so forth working on these issues. This last year, we deployed a 3-megawatt output solar array that covers about 11 acres just north of the college. And so there's a lot of things happening that are exciting, but none of them are particularly miraculous. These are things that are happening elsewhere and could happen in lots of other places. I think our claim to fame is we've tried to draw them together so that each of the parts helps to reinforce the larger pattern of development.
And the leadership piece is what you talk about, and it's so important. I mean, inspire people to greatness, get them excited about it. And I can't help but ask this question because I really don't want to be negative about anything, and I work on that every day because I want to have hope for the planet. But when you started the show, you talked about the culture and kind of the mindset and the history of Oberlin and the Underground Railroad. And it kind of lends itself to a more, what I would say, open-minded, all of the things that I am aligned with. Is this model, do you think with the right leadership you could take it, and of course there's always going to be differences in different communities, and replicate the model if it wasn't a community that was open to these possibilities? It has to matter a little bit that you had the people there that are probably drawn towards a more forward-thinking, progressive, and I may be wrong, but I just wonder, because you've gone around the country, is it something that you can take and replicate?
Gina, I think it's not only possible to replicate it, I think it frankly is going on virtually everywhere now. I don't think you can step into any middle-sized to large city in the country without finding citizen activists, robust solar movement, local foods movement, a green building movement. I think this is the wave of the future. I don't think it's impossible. I don't think we're doing anything that is. We're a little more organized in some places. Our scale is smaller, a little bit more manageable than cities like Tucson or Los Angeles or Chicago. But you can go into those cities. Los Angeles has just adopted a major solar initiative I saw in the paper the other day, and Chicago's been one of the leaders in the Green City movement, and so this is the future. And what this represents, frankly, is a failure of public policy at the very top to help lead and help guide. Instead, we get lots of resistance from people who I think have no good reason to resist. I don't think there's anything about sustainability that is inherently Democrat or Republican,
liberal or conservative. I totally agree.
I think it just makes common sense. You shouldn't. It's a good conservative principle not to waste energy. So that means on the application side, if you don't waste energy, then you've got to be concerned about energy efficiency. It's a good conservative principle to be concerned about the value of life. Well, on the other side, the operational side means you don't kill things unnecessarily. And so if you take that as a principle, not as an ideology, then you've got to work your way through to a food system and a public safety system and a foreign policy and a climate policy that don't end up killing people and destroying prospects for life. And that's, again, back to this point of connecting the dots. People have to learn to see patterns and why this is connected to that and that's connected to this. So on the food system, and I'm off on a rant here, but on the food system, we've got to understand that the way we eat is connected to the obesity epidemic in the country and also to the dead zone off the mouth of the Mississippi that's bigger than the state of New Jersey. And that's a matter of understanding the terms by which we eat and terms by which we presume ourselves to be prosperous. But it's all of a pattern. There's no mistake here. This is not an anomaly or a surprise. These are all things that come out of just simply the way we've organized our lives and our corporations and the ways we're provisioned of food and energy and so forth.
And I live in Tucson and I go to Phoenix frequently, and there, you're right, there are so many facets of sustainability going on and really good things happening, the proliferation of local foods and the whole local first concept. What I feel is missing and what frustrates me at times from the traveling I do is that there isn't the coordinated effort that the Overland Project so clearly represents. It's in some cases maybe full spectrum responsibility, but it's not the sense of an orchestra leader where we're all moving in the right direction. So on that note, we're going to have to take another quick break. And we come back, David, if we can, I'd like to go a little bit more into your definition of security and its much broader interpretation than just food. Please stay here with me. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Castle Rock Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
She's the most exciting thing that's ever happened to you, and you want to spend eternity with her. She deserves nothing less than the best, an Abbott Taylor original. A diamond engagement ring as exceptional as she is that will make her eyes sparkle every time she sees it. Because we design and make our own jewelry, we can create something wonderful for every budget. I'm Abbott Taylor. I'd like to invite you to come see what Abbott Taylor Jewelers has waiting for you. With 35 years and thousands of original jewelry designs, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. We're proud to say using recycled gold, we have saved over 100 million pounds of toxic waste from this planet. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
It's got advanced technology. It's got major breakthroughs in technology everywhere you look. It's the 2013 Honda Accord. Hi there, this is Mrs. Green, and I want to share with you that after nearly 40 years of heritage, this is the most stunning Accord ever. The highly respected Automotive Magazine raves that the 2013 Honda Accord offers unparalleled talent of goodness. Please visit Chapman Honda at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson to check it out and see for yourself.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Did you know that even a donated doorknob can help Habitat for Humanity? Habitat's Habastore accepts donated items like furniture, building materials, and appliances. Donations come from commercial builders, malls, restaurants, hotels, and individuals like you. Then, items are bought by bargain hunters who come across the very things they are looking for, just like the right doorknob. The best part is that Habastore sales generate funds for building homes. Call 520-889-7200 or visit habitattucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And if you are really listening, I think you're getting a lot to think about. And from where I sit, it's all good. We are so blessed and excited to have as our guest today, Dr. David Orr. He is the Paul Sears Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies and Politics and Special Assistant to the President at Oberlin College and Executive Director of the Oberlin Project. David, thank you so much for all of the things you're sharing. And for this segment, I would like to talk a little bit about security, because you do expand the definition beyond food security. And there's one of the things that I picked up from the myriad of things I wrote that you have written in doing my good homework. One sentence was, "No government on its own can protect its people in a black swan world." So tell us what you mean by that, and expand on the concept of security and why it's so much more, you know, a bigger concept than just our food supply.
Well, thanks for that. The phrase black swan comes from a risk analyst by the name of Nicholas Taleb, who wrote a book with that title. And the point of the title in the book is that all swans are white until one's black. And that's largely an unpredictable event. And so the idea that we live in a black swan world is that unpredictability is now part of the daily fabric. It's part of the world we live in. So you think of Fukushima, or think of the financial collapse in 2008, right, or these events, which are, a few may see them coming. There will be events that no one will see coming. In a tightly interconnected world where something happens in Hong Kong, but the effects ripple all the way to Paris, that's the world we live in now. And so it raises issues of how do we think about sustainability on one side and resilience, a related concept, but not quite the same thing, on the other. And so resilience means the capacity to absorb those kind of disturbances that are ecological or financial or in some cases physical and still function and keep the major core values and functions intact. So this takes us into security really quickly. And in a secure world, I would broaden the definition of security to include access to clean water, to food, to safety, to health care, to employment, to shelter and housing and so forth. So people who are really secure fear no particular threat, whether it's an army coming across a border or whether it's economic conditions that destroy livelihood and destroy neighborhoods. So the question we face, it seems to me, is how do we build a resilient world, one with some stretch in it, one with bend? And the concept of resilience is one that every engineer understands. You don't build rigid structures. You build structures with some give and some flexibility. There's no highway or bridge or building that is entirely rigid. It moves a bit with the wind, and in the case of California, it can shift a bit with earthquakes and so forth. So resilience, what's that mean in terms of a society? And I think what it means in this case is beginning to re-regionalize some of the basics, like food and like clean water and like energy production and like employment. So a lot of things can happen way out yonder, but the community can survive pretty much intact. Not in everything, because there are some things that will be that will affect us. We live in this interconnected world now. But we've spent trillions of dollars on something we call security in a world where our energy supply was tied to Middle Eastern oil. And you couldn't think of a dumber way to do that.
So true.
And instead of having the savvy, as Amory Lovins once put it, to put our kids in cars that get 50 miles per gallon, we had to put them in tanks in the Middle East that got 10 feet per gallon or whatever the number was.
But, and that don't work on the terrain. We have to bring that up. I just have to say some things like that on the air once in a while.
Yeah,
tanks aren't working so well in lots of places in Afghanistan. So go ahead.
No, that's exactly right. But we've created multiple problems when the solution a long time ago and all the way to the present has been efficiency, simply eliminating the wasted energy. And you can do that in the case of transportation by designing proximity in so you don't have to get in a car and move a couple of tons of steel from point A to point B to get a six-pack of beer. You can design proximity. You can design more efficient vehicles, which we've already done. I mean, think of the Prius, and there are better cars waiting to come that will get 100, 150, 200 miles per gallon. I don't think these are technical impossibilities. I think they're leadership issues. And so security in this case means rethinking lots more beyond simply the defense budget. And a secure people doesn't need to worry about dying from chemical contamination or dying from want or hunger or starvation or whatever, because we've organized our lives so that we're secure by design.
And we can't just leave it, like you said to me, one of the most important things that stuck out for me is it's really not something that we just should leave to the generals and the defense contractors and the politicians. It starts with neighborhoods and communities and towns really improving their own resilience, because that's all part of the what I call the safety net, or weaving that web so that we are not as vulnerable and thinking, oh my gosh, we're all protected because, you know, we have nuclear missiles. I mean, there is a false sense and even a sense of detachment in that thinking. And I do think a lot of people have the detached thinking. We're fine. We've got a great military. But the security of our country now, to me, is at risk in so many of these other areas that you point out. So what's
Well, we've squandered trillions of dollars to buy weapons that are counterproductive. Gandhi once said that weapons make us cowards. And I think there's more than a little truth in that.
I think there's a lot of truth
wall
in that.
Big enough. There's no missile shield robust enough. There's no army strong enough to keep us secure in a world where we've made people hate us. And so this is a kind of the psychological side of resilience, beginning to build a robust, resilient, fair, decent, solar-powered, hyper-efficient society that doesn't need to imperialize or colonize the world. We don't need to be involved in every part of the planet unless we choose to do it. But having to do it and choosing to do it are very different things.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. And along those lines, one of the most powerful lines I read that I actually put in here is, and you wrote it, I cross my heart, while we have become more vulnerable to a wide range of threats, revolution in the design of resilient systems has been quietly building momentum for nearly half a century. So I want to ask you, where do you see some of the most dramatic and positive changes? Are there other cities or projects you can refer to? Because I agree with you about seeing lots of signs of hope wherever you go, even if it's as simple as getting more recycling. It has to start somewhere. So what are some glowing examples you'd like to share?
Well, I think if you start at the individual level, the U.S. Green Building Council has pioneered and improved dramatically the way we build buildings relative to their environmental performance. That's a huge success story.
It really is.
And they've revolutionized the way you think about buildings and all the technologies that go into that, from glazing to solar systems and so forth. Those technologies are now incredibly good and getting better very rapidly. And if you think of in lighting systems, a 100-watt incandescent light bulb could be replaced with a 17-watt compact fluorescent, that can be replaced in terms of the 4-watt LED. And so the technology is going dramatically in the right direction. In terms of success stories, there are two made a list, but start at the very biggest cities. New York City, for example, under Mayor Bloomberg, has done amazing things to develop an environmental policy and building policy and lower carbon emissions and so forth. the same has been true in Chicago and Seattle and San Francisco and literally dozens of cities, if not hundreds, across the United States. And so I think there are success stories all around. They're not being reported. I think the cork in the bottle in the American system has been the media and its political system, both drenched in way too much money. And so you don't hear the stories, and the public policy changes, for example, in developing a national tax for carbon, which is essential. A lot of ways to do it, but that is absolutely essential. Congress has no mind to do it for lots of reasons, but they all boil down to simply too much money and too much ignorance. But there are so many success stories now. If we had unlimited amounts of time, I would be wildly optimistic. The problem is that we are coming down to the wire. Time is really short, and we are passing thresholds like mile markers and exit ramps along the interstate, and we can't go back. Once you've changed the atmospheric chemistry, then we and our descendants will live with that for a long, long time. That means more heat, more drought, changing ecologies, more unpredictability, rising sea levels, all the things that go with atmospheric chemistry. But I think there is something like an ecological enlightenment all over the world. The Chinese now produce more wind machines and solar systems than they do thermal coal-fired power plants. So the change is global. What we have to do is to make it even faster. But again, the tools and equipment to do that are right here. We don't have to invent
here. I know. I so agree with you. You know, I had, we did a pre-record, the show hasn't been aired yet, but it was part Ted Danson and part Andy Sharpless from Oceana. And he gave me hope too. I mean, he feels as though there's a great amount of momentum towards righting the shape of the world's oceans and waterways. And it was the first time, I mean, I came away from the Monterey Bay Sustainable Foods Conference with a lot to process. I mean, it was a lot of information in 2 days, and you didn't necessarily want to get up and, you know, it was very, you know, problem and solution focused, but we've got a lot of things to look at. So I love that you give me hope because of how I show up in the world, because I'm an example of media that wants to get the truth out and build the momentum towards all the good things that are happening. So thanks for pointing it out.
Well, Gina, thank you for doing what you're doing to get the word out and having such a good radio show.
I love it. So let's go to, for the end, what would you say the greatest impact of the Oberlin Project has been? If you could pick one, I know the Solar Hotel is going to make a lot. It's going to probably go viral on Twitter. People are going to really like that. That's fun and hip and sexy and sustainable. What do you think the greatest impact has been, not just for Oberlin and for the college, but for the message to the world? Because you're really on the road telling the story.
Well, I think that humans are visual creatures. We tend to believe what we see, touch, feel, experience, and so forth, but sight is so important to us. And the goal here is to create a model that people can see, touch, feel, experience of sustainability. And, oh, the food, by the way, is grown locally, and the power is all from renewable energy sources, and the craft work is all done locally, and our waste is recycled here on site. It's aiming to be a zero-discharge community with no waste product leaving. And it all takes time, but I think people believe success stories if they see them. And the goal here is to be able to create that model that people can see and experience.
It's Show Me, and you did. I mean, it's well on its way, and there are lots of things wonderful that are happening. And unfortunately, all good things must end, like this show. I want you to make sure I'm going to say this on the air to say hello to your wonderful wife who joins you on this walk and makes really good things happen for the planet also. And I'd like to do a call to action, David, and what my call to action is for my listeners, who there are thousands of them, is go to OberlinProject.org, www.OberlinProject.org, and learn more about it, learn what they're doing and what they have accomplished. And thank you so much. And you get the last word, David. Next week I have a show that's a best of show, because I'm going to be sustaining myself with my grandchildren.
So, good for you.
I know. Thanks so much for doing what you're doing, and I'm sure our paths will cross again, everybody. We had the pleasure of Dr. David Orr from Oberlin College, hearing everything about the Oberlin Project. Make it a great green week. If you're in the Southwest, hydrate. It's 112 out there. Thanks, David.
Gina, thank you.